Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, the new issue of Creation Magazine is out, and boy, is it good.
Oh, there's lots of good stuff in here. Water, aliens, bug joints.
Yeah, and we're going to have fun with all of them, beginning with the sun. Now, this is the spring edition, spring 2012, and they have an article. There's a quote here from a NASA lead investigator. They were looking at the sun, and it's so cool because they say this kind of thing over and over and over.
One of those buzzwords, the word surprising. This is a surprising result.
Surprising. And here's why it's always surprising to them, Fred. The stuff of science is predictions. When you can make a prediction and it comes true, then that's evidence that your theory might be valid. It makes it worth looking at.
Yeah. The evolutionary millions of years worldview, they would think that the sun and all the planets are from the same material.
Made from the exact same material in some kind of a spinning gas cloud, a nebula. And so when they look at the atoms, the elements in the sun, it should be similar to planets. Now, when evolutionists do this 10,000 times over, there is a major new discovery or observation, and they say, well, it's just stunning. It's so surprising. It's so shocking. We have to go back to the drawing board. That's the equivalent of all those predictions being falsified. And since it happens over and over and over, it's evidence that their theory is not correct.
Yeah, if we kept count of the times we've heard shocking and surprising and all these different buzzwords.
And even horrifying.
Yeah.
So here we have the sun. And what does this lead NASA investigator say? He's Kevin McKeegan, and they found out by sending a spacecraft out near the sun, they found out that the varieties of oxygen and nitrogen are different from what we find on the Earth, and that wasn't supposed to be.
That wasn't supposed to be. If their planets and sun are supposed to be coming from the same thing.
Yeah.
So this is what Kevin McKeegan said. He said, again, it's a surprising result.
He always.
The implication is that we did not form out of the same solar nebula materials that created the sun. Just how and why remains to be discovered.
All right. So once again, you'd think that the oxygen and nitrogen on the Earth and on Mercury and Mars, that these would all be the same variety, the same isotopes of what we find on the sun. Turns out they're not.
They're not.
Fred, it's just like when they said there was this huge gas cloud spinning a nebula, and it condensed into the sun and the planets. Well, then the sun should have 99% of the spin of the solar system. It doesn't. It has about 1%. And the planets have 99% of the angular momentum.
Yeah,
the
conservation of angular momentum. That's
yeah.
Right.
So they always say, well, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk it? It's the opposite of what we predicted.
Yeah. Certain planets spin the opposite direction. They don't predict that, right? Because the conservation of angular momentum
Right. Pretty
much doesn't allow that. Physics doesn't allow it.
Right.
If you push a bunch of kids on a merry-go-round and they all fall off over time as you push it faster, do they all spin off in the same direction?
Right. They do.
They do.
And that's the conservation of angular momentum. And so Venus revolves on its axis backwards. But now they found an exoplanet. We talked about this a year ago, I believe. An exoplanet that actually orbits its sun backwards. Orbits.
That's right.
And you try to have some catastrophic collision in space. Yeah. That's going to get a planet to orbit its sun backwards.
Backwards. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the Saturn's moons are backwards.
Revolving. They're revolving backwards. Right. Okay. So the sun, more evidence that the evolutionary theory of the solar system is not true.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of it. I highly recommend Spike Pisaris's DVD on our created solar system. We sell it right here at Real Science Friday. You can call us 1-800-8-ENYART. That's my last name. 1-800-836-9278. Or go to realsciencefriday.com, click on the store, go to the science department, and you'll just love Spike Pisaris's DVD that shows so many examples of how what we actually find strongly contradict the theory that the sun and the planets evolved.
That's right. So, Bob, I know you're in a debate online right now, and I just wanted to get an update because I hear that Aaron Ra said that there's absolutely no evidence for rapid sedimentation in the Grand Canyon.
No indication. So all those layers in the Grand Canyon, no indication that there's rapid stratification.
There's no indication. Is that true?
None. Well, how about millions of nautiloids?
Millions of nautiloids.
Nautiloid. You know, these nautiloids are this extinct marine species that look like an ice cream cone.
Okay. And they're how big are they?
Well, some are small, but many are as large as your arm or larger and even huge. And it turns out that in one small layer of the Grand Canyon, toward the bottom, one limestone layer that's about 7 feet thick, there is an average of one nautiloid fossil per square meter. It runs the length of the Grand Canyon, 277 miles and beyond. And when you do the math, Fred, if the nautiloids, now they'll go 50 miles, look at that layer, and sure enough, there are the nautiloids.
Wow.
When you do the math, there are hundreds of millions of nautiloids that were killed in this limestone deposit. And here's the fun part, and we have to thank Dr. Steve Austin for this discovery, publishing on this. These nautiloids, 15% of them are standing on their heads.
They're standing on their heads? Wow.
They died, and they didn't fall over. Now, gravity causes dead animals to fall over.
Yeah. I was in PE once, and I was doing a headstand, and we all were. Yeah.
Phys ed. Gym.
And somebody fell on my arm and broke my arm. So if some kind of flood or something buried our PE class.
And then so much sediment has to bury you and your whole phys ed class that it has to catch many of you still standing on your heads. That is evidence of rapid sedimentation. And Fred, that's just one piece of evidence. Not only that layer, that's just the typical limestone layer in the layers of the Grand Canyon, except that that's where all the nautiloids were killed. And it had to happen rapidly. It just had to happen rapidly.
Yeah, because it gradually, again, is silly that they'd be standing on their heads.
Right.
That's awesome. And I know there's tons more evidence
there's
you can present.
So
I'm
much.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
We only gave a highlight. I'm looking forward to your next post in
yeah.
the debate.
This will be round four, my post for round four in the debate at League of Reason with Aaron Ra, the very popular atheist. So I'd say the debate is going really well.
Bob, you mentioned a show last year that we did on the Anthropic principle about everything is so fine-tuned in the universe. Well, there's another example in Creation Magazine that we didn't talk about last year.
Mm-hmm. And it comes out of New Scientist, which is really fun because they're looking at water. Fred, they look at all these different properties of the physical universe, and they see that everywhere they look, everything is fine-tuned just perfectly. And when you look at a water molecule, hydrogen and oxygen, it should come apart. It looks like it should come apart. That's what it looks like. But lo and behold, scientists are figuring out why it doesn't just come apart. And there's a conclusion that's drawn in this article from New Scientist, which is an atheistic evolutionary publication.
Yeah, it says, we are used to the idea that the cosmos' physical constraints are fine-tuned for life. Now it seems water's quantum forces can be added to this just right list.
It's all just right. It's like, why does the water molecule stay together? And they found out by studying it that there is this quantum effect, Fred, that should break apart the water molecule. But then there's another quantum effect that exactly equalizes that first effect, and they cancel each other out. They say it's very fortuitous.
Very fortuitous.
I guess it is,
yeah,
right?
So they're saying it's kind of lucky that that happened?
Kind of lucky. And so we add this to all the other examples. Remember, we did talk about this when we did that show a year ago on the exoplanets. And even now they're finding planets that orbit their stars backwards, which is completely contrary to the prediction of how stars and planets would form. But so then...
How fortuitous.
So then... It turns out that they look at all these properties of the physical universe and they say, look, they're fine-tuned. That's the terminology even the atheists use, and they don't like that because tuning a guitar, that is a process that involves intelligence. So why would you find so many fine-tuned properties of the physical universe? For example, there are things like the exquisitely and extraordinarily fine-tuned parameters such as the gravitational force constant and the electromagnetic force constant. And then, Fred, there are certain numbers of electrons to protons, and that forms a ratio. And it turns out that the ratio is perfect. And then you have the extraordinarily unlikely precise value of the mass of an electron compared to the mass of a proton. And if they were slightly off, everything would break.
Yep.
The entire universe, your body, your eyeballs would explode. Everything would go poof. And here's the ratio. It's got to be 1 to 10 to the 36th power.
10 to the 36th
just
power.
Just picture one with 36 zeros after it. That is the precision of the ratio of an electron to a proton.
My goodness.
And so what the atheist says, they call it the anthropic principle, and they think because they gave it a name, they solved the problem. And they say, well, of course everything is perfect, because if it wasn't all perfect, we wouldn't be here to observe that it's perfect. So it has to be perfect.
It's fortuitous.
It is fortuitous. And so, Fred, we can add to those examples now water and New Scientist magazine saying we are used to the idea that the cosmos is fine-tuned for life. Now we can add to this just right list, we can add water.
That's right. Something else that's really cool about water, break it into its components. So, ooh. Bob, I was wondering if I gave you hydrogen and I gave you a piece of oxygen, would you know what that would combine to do?
No, this is
Could you throw hydrogen and oxygen on a fire?
No, this whole concept, it would explode, right?
Yeah, you would
you got a
that.
Fire, you want to put it out. So you throw some hydrogen and oxygen on it, and it explodes. It's a bigger fire. This is called emergent properties. Emergent properties appear in chemical elements. They appear in life. And they're things that could not be predicted. You could study, presumably, you could study hydrogen exhaustively so that you know everything there could ever be to know about hydrogen. Do the same with oxygen, and you would never predict water. You'd never predict it. Well, it turns out that living cells have this emergent property, Fred, where you could give somebody all the components of, let's say, the simplest cell in the human body, which is the red blood cell. It's made up with about 718, I think, different machines called proteins. You could give somebody all the building blocks for a cell, and even how many of each we're going to use, and you ask them, okay, now predict what the cell will look like and what it will do. They cannot predict because the cell has emergent properties.
Emergent properties.
How about a machine? You're an engineer.
Yeah. If I gave you like a typewriter and just broke it into a bunch of pieces and I gave that to you, could you put that together?
Well,
does that have emergent properties?
Now, I couldn't, but you could. You're the engineer, right? So you could, Fred. You could look at, you and other engineers could look at a pile of parts and say, okay, we're going to figure out what these parts make and tell us what kind of a machine and what the machine would do. That is the nature of machines that human beings make. But living cells are not like that. They have emergent properties. You cannot look at the parts and know what the cell is going to look like, what it will do. It has these extraordinary emergent properties such that it's not really accurate to say that a living cell is like a computer or it's like a machine. It turns out that living cells are far beyond what we know of as machines and computers. They use machines and computers, and they use them by the millions, even in a single cell, millions of computers and machines, but they're not machines. They're far superior to what a machine is.
Well, and it reminds me, too, if you think of like an FPGA chip or an ASIC chip that maybe is in your computer.
Oh, yeah.
It does some function. Maybe it controls your graphics, like your graphics chip.
Yeah.
If you look at that under a microscope, the closer you look into that chip, the simpler it gets, the bigger it gets, and the simpler it gets.
Oh, yeah, right, right.
So if you look into a cell with a microscope, it gets more complex as you look into the thing.
It gets more complex, and when we look at the complexity, it becomes baffling. What a good point. A computer is pretty sophisticated, but you look at it and you break it down and it becomes simpler and simpler to understand. The exact opposite phenomenon is happening with molecular biologists who are looking, and the deeper in they look and the smaller the bits they look at, the more bewildering it is becoming.
So I wonder if all this originated with a supreme designer or maybe aliens.
Right.
So we had a story on aliens that I kind of got a kick out of.
Oh, yeah, we sure do. In fact, that's in the current issue of Creation Magazine. That is so fun. Fred, they're always warning us about aliens. I don't know why we're looking for them with SETI. We're looking for aliens. The scientists keep saying, beware of the aliens.
Watch out for them. I love this quote. This is from NASA-affiliated research. They said that green aliens, green in quotes.
Green aliens like little green men from
Mars?
Well,
no, they're green. You know, like liberals are green today. Everything's green.
Oh, they're environmentalists.
We're going green.
So
they're environmentalist aliens.
The aliens will, they'll belong to PETA.
Tree-hugging aliens.
Earth first. So they're environmentalist-friendly aliens.
So they contact Al Gore, so they set up their ambassador.
Yeah.
And anyways, they said green aliens might object to the environmental damage humans have caused on Earth and wipe us all out to save the planet. To save the planet, they're going to wipe us all
out. Now, this comes from scientists at Penn State University. Penn State, who are working on a project with NASA, and they're literally saying, Fred, you're representing them correctly.
Yeah, it's a direct quote.
That the aliens will be mad at us because of global warming, and they're going to wipe out humanity. Therefore, we have to buy hybrid cars.
That's right. I knew Al Gore had an argument.
And Fred, this is really funny because we have the same thing with Stephen Hawking. You remember that? Hawking said that, and this guy's supposed to be like the most brilliant atheist in the world. Stephen Hawking said that if you're out one day, say at a park or wherever, and you come across some aliens, don't talk to them. Because they're probably going to be mean.
Yeah, that's. I remembered it differently, but I think you're right. I thought it was like, don't admit who you are. I'm a nautiloid.
Right. Yeah, so in fact, the same Stephen Hawking, this is the guy who said that because of global warming, we should go to the moon and Mars to survive global warming.
What's the temperature on Mars?
Well, Fred, he wants us to colonize the moon and Mars. And I got some of the temperatures here. On the moon, the daytime temperature is over 200 degrees. And neither the moon nor Mars, they don't have liquid water and they don't have oxygen. I mean, the Earth is the source of global warming from the Earth. So Mars, since it's 50 million miles further from the sun than we are, its temperature ranges from 1 degree down to 178 below zero. 178 below zero. I mean, this is so absurd. Why doesn't Stephen Hawking say to survive global warming, we should all go to Greenland?
Yeah.
Why don't we go to Antarctica, Siberia maybe?
Well, don't they admit that it's like in maybe 100 years you'll have one extra degree of warmth?
Yeah.
And so, let's see. I think today it's, what, a beautiful 71 degrees here in Colorado.
Yeah.
So 70, let's see, choice here, 72 degrees?
72.
Or minus how many degrees?
Minus 178 on Mars, 200 degrees on the moon, 200 degrees
this
Fahrenheit.
Hawking, this Hawking's a smart guy. I can see that's a tough choice.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
So this is embarrassing that these scientists, and this is published in the Guardian newspaper, and Creation Magazine picked up on it. They're saying, look, this is what we're up against. They don't believe in a global flood. They don't believe the strata in the Grand Canyon were laid down rapidly, even though there are millions of nautiloids in 1 7-foot-thick layer of limestone. They don't believe that God created us, but they all believe in aliens, the whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
They all believe in aliens.
And then they think the Mars rover is going to impress us with the real estate on Mars. I mean, it's a little bit different than when you go shopping for a house with a realtor here in the Mars rover.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm sorry, that's not a compelling case for me to move to Mars or want us to no. colonize Mars.
No, not at all.
Remember Sheila Jackson Lee? She's a congressman from Houston.
Oh, yeah.
When the Mars rover was on Mars, she asked, where's the flag?
Yeah, the one that we planted on
the moon. On the
moon, yeah. Right. And she's like, well, I thought we'd see the flag.
Yeah.
It's like, well, the moon is not Mars. The moon is further away than Mars. The moon is right next door, 250,000 miles. Okay, so, Fred, why don't we now talk about this article from the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Now, he said things about the complexity of life and living cells, and this was published in Science in the fall of 2011, and so it's in this current Creation Magazine. His name is Bruce Alberts, and he wrote this editorial in one of the leading journals in the entire world, Science, and he's talking about our state of knowledge, scientific knowledge, regarding the chemistry of life. With all the advances we're making, where are we at so far in understanding life?
Well, he admitted that as scientists learn more and more, we have increasingly come to recognize how huge the challenge is that confronts us. When I read that, it reminded me of a debate you had on TV that I saw when it first aired with Eugenie Scott.
Back in the 1990s, she's a leading anti-creationist scientist, and we were talking about junk DNA. And I said, Eugenie, don't you think we're just beginning to learn about genetics? And we'll figure out that there's some function for all this DNA.
And you predicted that, like science is supposed to work.
Right. And she said, no, we absolutely, she was adamant. We know everything we will ever have to know about genetics to affirmatively declare that this is all junk, that there's no purpose for any of this. Fred, people could listen to that debate at kgov.com/Eugenie.
That's right. And you predicted that she was wrong and that we're going to learn a lot more. And since then, most of this junk, if not all of it, has pretty much been dismissed as it's not junk. It has some function.
Right. Every time they study a piece of DNA that they thought had no function, it turns out it has important function. So now, while there were 20,000 regions of our DNA that coded for proteins, and they thought that was pretty much it. Compare us to chimps, and that's it. We're 99% the same as chimps because we have the same protein coding segments. So then they said, well, okay, 98%, then 95%. Now they've sequenced the entire chimp Y chromosome, and it's 30% different. They're stunned. They were horrified. Yeah, 30% different than the human Y chromosome.
So human and chimp Y chromosome is 30% different.
Right. So 70% similarity, and that's getting you to the same kind of similarity when you compare the protein coding segments between humans and kangaroos or humans and sponges.
Yeah.
So, Fred, this was such a superficial prediction on their part that, well, if they're similar proteins, that must mean that we're closely related regarding evolution and that all this part of the genome, the majority of it that we don't understand, over 90%, it's all junk.
Yeah.
Those were very arbitrary and superficial predictions that turned out to be wrong on their part.
Completely wrong. And one of the things they were finding is mutations in this area that was supposedly junk was causing problems, diseases.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So what's a mutation in an area that's not supposed to have function causing a disease? That obviously it has
right.
a function.
Has a function. So this editor-in-chief of the journal Science says that because all living things on Earth are related through evolution, right? That's his assumption. He thinks that, therefore, we're going to discover how simple cells work, and then we'll figure out evolution. But even then, Creation Magazine continues to quote Bruce Alberts, biologists will need the help of mathematicians, computer scientists, and engineers to make sense of the enormously complicated network of molecular interactions found in even the least complex living cells. He's not kidding, Fred.
No, no doubt.
Even the least complex cells. Notice he didn't say the simple cells. Another prediction, Real Science Friday. They're going to stop talking about simple cells.
They're going to stop. Very simple.
They're going to stop talking about simple cells because of how wildly complex the least complex cells are. So this is a really fun thing to look at the enormous complexity of living cells. And Fred, what the Bible says in Romans 1:20, that those who deny the Creator are without excuse.
Without excuse.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, you know, and then an article right next to this one, we have that buzzword again, something that was a big surprise to evolutionists when looking at mutations that occur in the cell.
That's right. Big surprise. It turns out that not all mutations are created equally. In fact, they don't all appear equally, do they?
They don't. I mean, you'd expect there to be maybe a somewhat similar number of mutations for each kid from parents.
And from kids from neighboring households.
Yeah.
From different families, you'd think that each generation would have about the same number of mutations on average for their children.
Yeah, and they found that it was varying by as much as tenfold. So, for example, little Johnny might have 10 mutations and Sarah might have 100. You would expect it to be more of an equal amount. Because it's supposed to be a random...
Random. Things that happen randomly over 3 billion base pairs in your amino acids. Like kids generally receiving 3 mutations or 14 mutations, but not certain families having 3 mutations and others having 70 mutations. There's some indication there that what we think of as a purely random process is not purely random, and something is going on. And Fred, this was the Real Science Friday show. Last week, you were on assignment, and I got to interview Jonathan Bartlett about good mutations occurring on demand. And we talked all about the antibodies that your body creates to fight germs.
Oh, that's a cool mechanism.
Bacteria. It's just astounding. And you need a customized antibody for each different kind of bacteria. So it turns out that what we used to think of as just random mutations are targeted mutations happening frequently in a certain tiny segment of your DNA in order to customize antibodies when you get, let's say, some kind of a flu or a bacteria and it's starting to overwhelm your body. And so your body wants to target that thing and wipe it out. So we have these on-demand good mutations occurring.
Yeah. It's using randomness to try to zero in on a target to match so that it can kill the attacking parasite or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, really fun. Okay, maybe time for one last story.
Okay.
These bug joints.
Bug joints.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, joints like in our legs, in our arms, our elbows, our knees, there are ball and socket joints. Well, it turns out that evolutionists are trying to explain a certain little weevil of a bug. It has the most unusual kind of hip and leg joint that's ever been seen in a bug.
Yeah. Basically, the leg screws into the hip, right? And there's a nut type mechanism in the leg.
It's just astounding, Fred. When human beings invented the screw and nut threading mechanism, this was a major engineering breakthrough.
Yeah, that's right.
Major. So you have a million species of bugs that have this ball and socket type joint. So one bug is going to have his leg screw into a nut, and that's his joint.
Yeah, the muscles pull the legs in and out of the screw mechanism. So I'm wondering how this evolved, because, you know, when you look at a screw, it has threads that are very precise around the screw, and then the nut has to match it for you to be able to screw
them
together.
Yeah, the threads have to match. If they're a little off, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And not only that, presumably you start with a ball and socket. And that's going to have to somehow change to where you need threads. And what? The first time the threads start to evolve with no goal in mind, then the leg just keeps falling out of the joint. And that has to go on for how many thousands of generations before blindly the leg starts to evolve opposite threads that will screw into the threads in the hip.
It's amazing, because if you damage even just the smallest part of a screw, you can't get that nut on. I mean, how many times have we tried that? And you have to force it on sometimes.
Right.
So to think that this happened by chance, Bob,
is
screwy and nutty.
That's right. I love how God designs these muscles that pull the leg in and out of the joint as it screws in and screws out. It's all stunning.
What amazing.
What an amazing creator we have. His name is Jesus Christ. Hey, check out realsciencefriday.com. May God bless you. Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, all from our website, kgov.com, or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart Debates Atheist Zaketh, a Psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the Earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder, and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-NYARDS, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com.